Welcome to the House of Pod, a show where we pull back the curtain on the world of medicine, we answer questions about your health, and we interview great guests.
I'm Joe, and I'm not a doctor.
And I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Kaveh.
And we're two gastroenterologists.
What's a gastroenterologist?
You know, the doctors who work with your digestive system.
Say what?
You know, your liver, your pancreas, your intestines.
Where now?
Your butt, Joe. It's your butt.
Oh.
Hey, everyone. We just want to say that we know COVID-19 is on everyone's mind and causing fear. There is so much that is not known, and it feels like our leadership is fumbling. Hopefully, we are now heading in the right direction. We want to remind everyone to take a deep breath and appreciate your health. Please remember to avoid big crowds, wash your hands with soap and water, or an alcohol-based wash. Be smart and be safe. Today's interview is about a different public health crisis that we can learn from. Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha represents what it means to believe in good science, common sense, and urgency. She is a pediatrician and a researcher who helped to expose the toxic lead that was in the water and poisoning the children of Flint, Michigan. And more important, she has acted as a public health advocate, even when it didn't help her personal goals. We need people like Dr. Mona leading the containment of and fight against corona. We can learn from her story, and hopefully you will take away something that we can all agree on, that protecting our health and the health of those around us should be the most important priority during a pandemic and every other day. Stay tuned.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie. That is more like it.
Did you like that one?
I did. Because when you're mellow, it like freaks me out and I'm worried about you. When you're all like, and welcome back.
Yeah, like people don't like my NPR sort of like fresh air voice. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't. And admittedly, it's not really who I am that much, but I can't always be at an 8 or a 9. Sometimes I'm like at a 5 and that's okay.
And with us, you can be comfortable. You can be yourself. Yeah. I didn't think of it as your NPR voice. I think of it as you impersonating Joe voice because he's all like constantly mellow.
He is the more mellow of us.
Like, yeah,
I notice episodes when I listen to them where it's just you and me talking.
Yeah,
like it's much faster.
Right.
There's a
right, and this is why Joe needs to like adjust levels all the time after, because you and I are all like, what? How much caffeine can we put in our mouths in one episode? And Joe's all like, hey guys, I forgot the question. Can we start over? Just so you know, we haven't talked about Joe's herpes in a while. I think we're going to have to bring that up in the next few weeks.
I know. We'll wait till he gets here.
Yeah.
He doesn't have herpes. Anyways, not that we know of. So we have a really cool guest coming up, and we should get to it because there is a lot to discuss with Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha. She is a pediatrician and a researcher, and she is the doctor that's really responsible for blowing the lid off of the whole Flint water crisis. So, I mean, if you haven't already heard of her, you will. I'm sure at some point there's going to be a movie made of her. She's like our generation's Erin Brockovich or something.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. It's a really great episode. And if you want to contact us, remember, find us at Twitter, at the House of Pod. Find us on Facebook and find us at hopquestions@gmail.com or call us at 408-444-6623. We have stickers. If you want them, please let us know. We will send them to you. If you haven't already, like us and subscribe to whatever listening device or channel you use. If it's iTunes, leave a review. Anything else?
No, that covered it. Great job.
Sweet. On today's show, we have Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha, a pediatrician, researcher, and public health advocate whose work has helped to expose the Flint water crisis, and I think was really at the heart of exposing the Flint water crisis. She's still working to help fix that situation in Detroit that's caused by these dangerously high levels of lead in the water. Dr. Mona, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Kaveh. Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Will you tell us a little bit about your background? Just kind of your parents are, I read, are from Iraq, and then you moved to England and Michigan. How did that journey kind of get you to Michigan and to Flint, Michigan specifically?
Yeah, I mean, it's all by accident. So I wasn't supposed to be in this country. So I'm an immigrant, came to this country when I was 4. My family's Iraqi American. We came to this country for really what all immigrants come to this country for opportunity and democracy and freedom and that American dream. And that was absolutely realized for me and my family. And I woke up every day lucky to be in this country, but also acutely aware of what injustice can be, what people in power can do to vulnerable populations. And I think it was that kind of sense and those immigrant values that were driven into me of service, of justice, that pushed me to go into medicine and pushed me to end up being in Flint and serving as a pediatrician.
Yeah. Yeah. The immigrants rock. We're all for them here.
Yeah.
Immigrants get the job done.
That's right. I haven't seen Hamilton yet, but I'm assuming that's a Hamilton thing.
Oh, my God.
I know. I'm being judged. I feel so judged. I'm working on it.
In San Francisco.
I know. Let's fast forward then to 2015. But you were the first person to expose that the blood levels in children had doubled in Flint because of this switch from the Detroit River, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, where the water used to come from, and it was switched to the Flint River. And because of this switch, and we'll get to the reasons why that was done, you start to notice that lead levels were doubling in children. Is that correct?
Yeah, a little bit. So, yeah, mostly. But the water that we had been getting in Flint was from the Great Lakes. So Michigan is the mitten state. We are absolutely surrounded by fresh water. It's the largest source of fresh water in the world is around Michigan and around Flint. And for half a century, we were buying our water from Detroit, but it was coming from the Great Lakes. So not the Detroit River, but the Great Lakes. And then in 2014, kind of in a move driven by austerity, our water source was switched from the Great Lakes to the Flint River. The Flint River water wasn't being treated properly. It was missing this kind of critical ingredient, which I had never heard of as a doctor, but now I feel like I should get an honor degree about, called corrosion control. And without that ingredient, our water was about 20 times more corrosive than the water that we had been getting from the Great Lakes. And that corrosive water, that untreated corrosive water, for 18 months kind of ate up our pipes, our infrastructure, which is predominantly lead-based, and the lead kind of leached out of our pipes and into our drinking water and ultimately into the bodies of our children. As a pediatrician in Flint, as an academic, as a residency director, I was seeing patients who were coming in with lots of concerns about the water. The people in Flint definitely knew something was wrong. There was concerns about color and odor and taste and red flags after red flags. And throughout this period, there was lots of reassurance by government that everything was okay. You know, there was bacteria advisories, and then people were like, oh, boil your water. We'll just add more chlorine. And then so much chlorine was added, it created a buildup of a carcinogen because of so much chlorine. But they're like, oh, everything's okay. And then they found out that the corrosive water was actually eating up engine parts at a General Motors plant. And General Motors was allowed to go back to Great Lakes water. And throughout, the people of Flint were told that everything was okay. And me, as a pediatrician practicing in Flint, was also telling my patients that everything was okay because all these government officials and scientists were saying everything that was okay.
That's amazing. Right. It's amazing to think that like the factory making car parts were like, oh, this is not safe for cars.
Yeah. Right.
The people can still have it, but the cars not so much. You can correct me on this one, but this all started because Flint, they had to have these emergency managers come in to take over sort of the city, right? Like the mayors and all the elected officials sort of lost control. And then these sort of emergency managers came in who are making these decisions based on sort of no accountability to the public. Am I reading that correctly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the crisis was born out of a loss of democracy. The emergency managers were appointed by the governor. They had no accountability. They were unelected. And all their decisions were driven by saving dollars.
So there was a political crisis, and that led to kind of an economic, cost-cutting, bad decision-making.
Yeah, and it was really, when I talk about the water crisis, especially in my book. There's a lot of history that's included. The water crisis, the political crisis, the economic crisis didn't happen overnight. It really took decades in the making. And it's something that I teach my kind of medical students and my residents, and something that I was taught, that we really have to know the history of the places that we're privileged to serve in. Because a lot of the things that we are treating, be it diabetes or asthma or obesity or, you know, whatever disparities, these things didn't just kind of present to our clinic that day. They've really been kind of in the making for quite some time. And just like this crisis, like it really started with decades of disinvestment, plants closing, unemployment, mm-hmm. poverty, redlining, blockbusting, racism, greed, income inequality, and kind of the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
That really kind of set up the situation where democracy was taken away, and where these kind of austerity-driven policies were put into place that created the situation. It could have been predicted when you understood the history.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone wants to see an extreme version of reality of Flint, probably see Roger and Me from probably 30 years ago, Michael Moore's film about Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
But so can you tell us, you know, you said patients were coming to you. Is that what made you... You were just curious and investigated, or did people actually have symptoms, or did they just come to you and say, you know, Mona, my kid's been drinking brown water. Can you make sure the kid's okay?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. I love that question. And that's something that is so critical to the story, because it had nothing to do with what I was seeing in my patients. So the title of my book is actually What the Eyes Don't See. We don't see lead in water. Kind of that colored water was from iron corrosion, creating rusty colored water.
Yeah.
But lead exposure is well known in pediatrics and public health as a silent pediatric epidemic. I wish patients would present to clinic like it was like glow in the dark purple spots when they had lead exposure. Yeah. But they don't. Yeah. It's invisible. There's a gap from when you have exposure to the presentation of symptoms, which are things like, you know, drop in cognition and attention problems, focusing problems. And then by the time that child has those symptoms and exposures, you know, symptoms and signs, the exposure was years prior. So what kind of really helped me realize what was going on was a random dinner party with a high school girlfriend. So a big lesson of my story is make friends with folks who are outside of your specialties, who are outside of your disciplines. Yeah. In medicine, we become hyper-specialized and we tend to only hang out with folks who are just like us. And by pure randomness, a high school girlfriend came over for a last minute barbecue in the summer of 2015. We were chatting, and my high school girlfriend of all things is a drinking water expert, formerly at the EPA, who was at the EPA over a decade ago when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis. And in my kitchen, glass of wine in our hands, she's the one that told me that the water wasn't being treated properly in Flint. And because of that, there would be lead in the water. Hmm. And that was the very first time I heard the word lead. I'd heard about the color and the odor and the taste and the bacteria and all these different things. But that was the first time I heard the word lead.
Yeah.
And that's what prompted me to do the research to see what was happening with our children's lead levels. And this is where I really credit my kind of training and background in public health, because I was able to take this population level perspective. I'm just one doctor in one clinic in Flint. Like, I can tell you about lead levels in my patients, but I can't tell you what's happening at a population level. So you really need that lens to be able to step back and to see kind of what those trends were.
Yeah.
And I know this is probably pretty basic for most of the doctors that listen to our show. Maybe not. They need to hear it too. But for the non-doctors, can you tell us what the dangers of lead in the water is?
We know that the kids don't turn neon, like you said, which would be helpful, but like the subtle clues, I guess.
Yeah, so lead is probably one of the oldest and most well-studied poisons. We've known what lead has done really for centuries. This last summer, I went to Pompeii, Italy, and there's perfectly preserved lead pipes. And there's the strong theories that the hypothesized demise of the Romans is because they were exposed to so much lead. Not only did they use it in their plumbing, But lead was also put in their food as like a salt and a sweetener. So we've known about lead's toxicity for quite some time. And over the last few decades, incredible science has got us to the point of recognizing that there is no safe level of lead. Levels we thought were okay decades ago when industry put lead in gasoline and paint and plumbing, we now know are not okay because of what it does, especially to developing brains. It drops children's IQ levels and impacts cognition. It impacts behavior and development, leading to things like developmental delays, attention disorders, focusing problems. It's even been linked to things like violent behavior, oppositional defiant disorder, and even to criminality. We also know increasingly about the epigenetics of lead, how the transmission of lead exposure can affect future generations. So because of this incredible science, we know that there's no safe level and that we are supposed to practice something called primary prevention, which in public health means that children are never supposed to be exposed to lead, that our focus really should be finding lead in the environment rather than continuing to use the blood of our children as detectors of environmental contamination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you get this information that shows that there is these increased lead levels, and then you have a press conference. And at this time, you had the data, you had this information, but it wasn't peer reviewed. It wasn't in a journal, right? Did you get a lot of pushback when that happened? And did you get criticism specifically for that aspect of it?
Well, because for our listeners, I mean, normally, I guess when we hear about stuff, it's through the media, but it's probably already been vetted by your peers, in these journals that, you know, normal people don't read, you know, New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Public Health, right? I think that's where your first article was published. And then, you know, then there's a press conference. So you kind of, you did a backwards order, right?
Yeah. Well, we had no choice. So that peer review process, which is critical, which has been around for really centuries, where your peers look at your work and critique it, that process takes a long time, months, sometimes years, to get something through that peer review process. And when we found out our research, and we had checked and double checked and triple checked and ran it a bazillion different kind of ways because of paranoia, and being OCD scientists, and doctors, we knew it was right, but we couldn't afford that time, that luxury of time to go through that process. So what we did was kind of an act of academic disobedience. And I literally kind of walked out of my clinic with my white coat on and stood up in our hospital conference room at a press conference and shared these research findings and demanded action. Even though it hadn't gone through that peer review process, everything I did and I continue to do is definitely part of my job, my responsibility, my role as a physician. One of the reasons I went into medicine and specifically pediatrics is the job of being an advocate. Like, you know, we wear many hats, and it's not like we all have to wear these hats, but the hats that we can wear are those as a clinician, as a researcher, as an educator, but also very much as an advocate. Mm-hmm. It's also one of the reasons I went back and got my public health degree in health policy, because I wanted to be able to not only treat that patient in front of me, but to try to address the upstream issues that you know, force a lot of these ailments in our patients.
Did you get a lot of pushback from your institution, your bosses? Did you feel like your career was maybe threatened at the time that you kind of just went straight to the media? Was that an issue for you?
Yeah, so you'll have to definitely get all the dramatic details in my book. but yeah, so it was, you know, I had just gotten a Fitbit right before this all happened. And when I released this research and began to get pushback from the state, and every arm of the state, and I even tried to prepare myself that this would happen, my heart rate was close to 200. So I was, you know, physically tachycardic. I was anxious. I felt sick. I began to second guess myself. I also began to tell myself, like, oh, you know, maybe I should have just stayed quiet. Maybe I should not have, you know, looked at this. Maybe this wasn't my job. Maybe somebody else was going to do this. You know, maybe, you know, I shouldn't have gone public. So I also very much began to think that you know, that this was a bad idea. And fortunately, and quite quickly, you know, the numbers in my research, it was a realization that this had nothing to do with me, and that these numbers and statistics and p-values and what have you, every single one represented a child. A child as a physician, like I have literally taken an oath to stand up for and fight for. So it was as if those kids like jumped out of my spreadsheets and lifted me up and gave me the courage to keep going. And we fought back with more numbers and more science and more evidence and more data. And finally, through our teamwork and our persistence, the state conceded. I want the resources and the interventions to make sure that our kids not only recover and thrive from this. Yeah. You know, I think the science has been really clear. This, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote this book is not just to, you know, just, and one of the reasons I love sharing the story is not just to share kind of the story about this crazy thing that happened to Flint, but really to bring home some of the kind of the bigger lessons. And one of that is what happens when we deny science. Yeah. Yeah. So the story of Flint is a story of just common sense science being denied, like basic water treatment, attacking science, attacking scientists. And this is what happens when we deny science. But it's also this really powerful story of what happens when science and scientists come out of their ivory towers, when we come out of our classrooms and our hospitals, and we speak our science, and when we work hand in hand with the communities that we are privileged to serve. Mm-hmm. So not only is the story of this, you know, what happens when you deny science, but it also is such an important story, especially for doctors. You know, so many of us went into medicine because we want to help people. Yet, obviously, so many of us have gotten jaded over time. But let this story serve as an example of really the power of our voice.
Yeah.
You know, the doctor in the story never should have had to do what I did. So many people were raising red flags. But it was finally when that doctor spoke that things finally started to happen. So let it serve as a reminder that as physicians, we have this really credible, powerful voice in our communities, and people are waiting to hear from us.
Yeah, I think it's a great example. You know, people or a lot of doctors hear research and you think of like the lab and rats and stuff like this. And this is a great way for you to have done this and actually apply it to a human being kind of immediately. And then and that obviously catapulted, I think, into more pediatric public health initiatives. So is that something that you got into mostly after, or do you want to tell us about the Flint Kids Fund?
Yeah. So in the same kind of speed and around the clock urgency that we had to uncover this crisis is the same speed that has continued to mitigate the impact of this crisis and to improve kind of the health and development of Flint kids and really kids kind of beyond the story. So I founded and directed a pediatric public health initiative, which is based in Flint. And we work with many of our community partners, including amazing Flint kids and Flint parents, to put into place the science-based interventions to make sure that our kids turn out okay. So once again, it's a story of science being denied, science speaking truth to power, but also really leaning on the incredible science of child development and brain plasticity and resilience to mitigate the impacts of this crisis. We're also hoping that kind of what we do in Flint has the ability to shine a light on other communities. And we've already seen that. There's been so many positive ripple effects of the Flint story to really kind of raise the nation's consciousness on issues of, for example, drinking water and environmental injustices and infrastructure and democracy and the respect for science. But it also speaks very much to kind of the condition of children everywhere. And this, as a pediatrician, this is kind of what keeps me up at night because just like Flint kids, there's kids all over this country that wake up to some of those same nightmares as Flint kids, be it overwhelming poverty or environmental contamination or lost democracy or stolen opportunity, these same situations that make it impossible for these kids to really to get ahead.
Well, you don't know yet, but we have a third co-host with us, Joe. He's not a doctor, and he left us a voicemail because he was really excited that you were going to be with us today, but he just couldn't make it. So, you know, these are gems. Joe is... he's our genius, but also has really low points. He's our greatest highlights of the show and our lowest as well. So sometimes he forgets the question in the middle, but we have him on voicemail now. So if it's okay, we're going to play it for you.
Yeah.
Actually, he
called and left a couple of voicemails for you. So we're just gonna, we'll pick maybe just two of them. Okay, I'll play it for you, and we'll get your response.
Hi, Mona. This is Joe. I've got a question for you. In my opinion, you know, our country seems to be very soft on crime, especially related to product safety in general, it seems like. Whether it be in this situation or others, we have leaders putting humans in harm's way purposely for some other motive, some usually due to money. What do you feel should happen to the local officials in Flint, Michigan, responsible for all this? And do you feel stricter laws, including criminal prosecution, could serve as a deterrent in the future in these types of situations? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
Did you hear that?
Yeah. So Joe has a great question about accountability. And that is so critically important. And often when people ask me these kind of questions, I would defer. I'm like, oh, I'm a doctor. I'm not a prosecutor. But then I've really come to realize that this concept of restorative justice is so critical for healing, because without that accountability and without that justice, it's very, the trauma is real and it is raw and it is every day. So in Flint, that's critical. It hasn't completely happened yet. Nobody's gone to jail yet for the crimes that were conducted. There have been criminal investigations. People have lost their jobs. There's been many investigations from the EPA, to the Civil Rights Commission, to what have you. But the criminal lawsuits and the civil lawsuits are still to this day ongoing. But it's critically, critically important. And Joe mentioned local officials. This was not a local issue. This was a state and federal problem. So the crux of the blame lies at the state level because we were under state control with emergency management. But also part of the blame is with the EPA. And an EPA Inspector General report actually said that the EPA should have acted 7 to 9 months sooner based on what they knew.
Good job, Joe. That's a good question.
All right, let's see if we can go 2 for 2 with Joe.
That was awesome.
Oh, hi, Mona. This is Joe. I'm totally blown away by the story in Flint, Michigan. I've got a question for you regarding some of the statistics. I read it was estimated that between 6 and 12,000 children were exposed to excess levels of lead in the water supply in Flint. What does this mean for these children health-wise, and have there been any follow-up statistics on this group regarding their current health conditions? Are these folks experiencing health issues related to lead poisoning right now? Would love to hear your thoughts.
Okay, first of all, Joe did the, hi, how weird, I'm making a phone call thing. And
hey,
then,
hey, it's me calling into my show. Yeah,
and these questions are so good, I'm pretty certain somebody else wrote them for him.
That second one is amazing. That is amazing. I love this guy.
Something funny is going on. Sorry, so did you hear that one as well?
Yes. Yeah, Joe was brilliant.
Yeah, sometimes he is.
Yeah.
He must have really good ghostwriters.
Yeah.
So so everybody who drank this water was exposed to the crisis. So our denominator of exposure is about 150,000 people. Those are the people that lived in Flint, went to school in Flint, worked in Flint, went to daycare in Flint. And it is that population that is actually being tracked over time. So we have been funded by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to build a Flint registry. So this is modeled after other large-scale registries like the World Trade Center Registry, which has been following folks over time. Our Flint registry launched earlier this year. We've already gotten several thousand people enrolled. There's surveys they take to see how they're doing, how their health is, how their development is. But unlike other registries that are just kind of tracking people and sharing that research, this is a public health registry, which means once we find out how people are doing, they then get connected to the interventions to mitigate the impact of the crisis. For example, if it's a child, we then refer them to, for example, early education and literacy support and childcare and healthcare access. So that is the beauty of this registry, which is launched. It's not just about tracking folks over time, but it's really about making sure that we do not see those consequences that we already know that through clear science that lead does.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I have one more question for you. You've mm-hmm. been really generous with your time. I really appreciate it. You've testified in front of Congress twice now?
Uh-huh.
What was that experience like?
It was fun.
Fun.
It was fun.
Wait.
What
did your Fitbit register your heart rate during that testimony?
So, you know, I have been on the phone and testified with policymakers continuously. I have been in front of media. You know, at one point there was days where I had like 16 interviews a day. And, you know, nothing can prepare you for this. But what I try to share with other physicians is try to be prepared. So I was blessed, for example, in my training in pediatrics to have had things like advocacy training. So it wasn't the first time that I talked to a legislator. Every year I take my pediatric residents to the state capitol, and we meet with our local state legislators about whatever bills may be, you know, in play that session regarding things that affect children's health. But before we go and meet with legislators, we do things like advocacy training. We do role playing. I pretend I'm the legislator and my resident talks to me and they get their nerves out and they realize, hey, they're just a regular person. Mm-hmm. And in addition, in my kind of doctor training, I've had things like media training. Like whenever the hospital said, hey, who wants to talk about, you know, the importance of flu vaccines? I'm like, oh, I'll do it. Like, yeah, it's scary and it's weird, but I'll try. Mm-hmm. So take advantage of those opportunities. Do things like podcasts and really cool interviews.
Well, it seems like a little bit of a jump from this to going in front of Congress, but sure, I feel ready.
I think it's the same.
No, it's just practice and practice and practice. And especially as physicians, like we are experts. Like we are an expert in our discipline. That sense of imposter syndrome never goes away. But just as if, you know, when we're in the room with a patient, like we have to exude kind of confidence in what we know and what we can impart. I think so much of the situation that we're in terms of kind of science denial and vaccine denial and what have you is because, you know, we as scientists and doctors don't go into the halls of Congress or other important places and communicate what our science and medicine is all about.
Yeah.
So kind of that's another critical lesson or story, and especially my story, is that we have to be prepared and we have to do more of this so people can understand the importance.
Yeah. Doctors have to be better advocates and get more politically active. That's totally. Yes, and people do listen to doctors.
We have to do things like this, and we have to not only write for, you know, journals that five people read, but we also have to write like op-eds in our local papers and, reach other audiences.
Right. That's what we're trying to do with this podcast. And I do think that the podcast is very similar to testifying in front of Congress, except there are fewer white guys in suits here with us today. So we really,
and I can be in my pajamas right now. And you didn't know.
You probably are. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your dedication and being so relentless for your patients and the kids and the people of Flint and the repercussions it has across the nation. So thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Thank you to both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, one last thing. Where can people find the book? Where can people get the book?
What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City.
Yes, it is available anywhere.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns. All anecdotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.